It's New Letters on the Air. Today we'll hear from Missouri writer Mary Troy, whose books of short stories capture the humor and tragedy in life. She talks about how she uses the emotions of both to shape her work.
There are some stories that just are sad, that there's no humor that will redeem them, but not many. I do think that most things are a combination.
Discover the fiction of Mary Troy on this edition of New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. The author of three collections of short stories, Mary Troy has won the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Award for her work and is currently the director of the Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, a place she's returned to after years away in Arkansas and Hawaii. Fellow fiction writer Michael Pritchett, who teaches on the other side of the state at UM Kansas City, talked with her in 2004 to discover how place has inspired her work.
I know that you've grown up in the St. Louis area. You've lived in Hawaii for part of your life. Mm-hmm. Then you got your MFA at the University of Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been around a couple of different places, but then you came back to St. Louis. Could you talk a little bit about how that happened?
Well, I went back to St. Louis mostly by accident. After I left St. Louis, I thought I would probably never live there again, and I loved living in Hawaii. It was absolutely fantastic. It is the paradise that people call it. But when I went for my MFA, I went to Arkansas, and I also was crazy about Fayetteville, but I couldn't get a job when I graduated. My timing was pretty bad. This was like the mid-80s, and schools were starting to do more adjunct hiring. And so I decided that until I got a book published, I had to do adjunct teaching. And so I came to St. Louis because I still had family there, and I knew a number of universities and colleges around there, and I thought that, you know, I could pick up a class here and a class there, and had no intention really of making it my permanent home. But then I got this good job at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and so there I am.
The places that the St. Louis stories take place, they're all these amazing names, and I just pulled out one, LaBelle's House of Beauty. I just think that's great. It's one of those places that you drive by and you would never stop to get your hair cut there. I mean, that has to be some place that only the locals go. Are these places from your growing up, or are they places that you lived near in adulthood?
Yeah, they're places I lived near in adulthood. When I was growing up, I was raised in a suburb of St. Louis that at that time was like a small farming community. It was Florissant, Missouri. And when I was growing up, I didn't really feel like I lived in St. Louis exactly. It could have been anywhere. But after I moved here from Arkansas, my husband and I got a place down in the South City. And we did it, I think, mainly because it was inexpensive. And it was an odd area to me. It had been really traditionally a bastion of old German immigrants, but like third or fourth generation by now. And the area we lived in was even called Dutch Town, and there was this idea of the scrubby Dutch and the women, the old sort of heavy set, they weren't old, but they looked old, you know, sort of heavy set women in their house dresses who would have fed their husbands and have them sit in the lazy boy in front of the TV by 6 o'clock in the evening so they could visit with their friends on the front stoops, and they'd have their hair in curlers. It was a strange place, but it was on the verge of changing. Most of those old women were dying out, the old families, and they were moving to the suburbs. And the new people who were moving in were all different ethnicities. I mean, there were a whole lot of Vietnamese moving in, and then there would be sort of young gangs roaming around. It was becoming a really poor place. But it still had that other idea to it, what it used to be. And I'd never lived right in a city before, so close to everybody with the street noises and the fights you could hear all over. And, you know, we had neighbors who were shooting guns in the alley just for fun. And it was a wild time. And it did inspire me to set my whole first collection down there.
That's great. I'm curious to know how you wrote your first two collections of stories. I think of you mainly as a story writer, although I know you're working on a novel. And if you could talk a little bit about how you wrote your first two collections, first Joe Baker is Dead and then The Alibi Cafe.
All right. I am primarily a short story writer, and I have another collection coming out pretty soon, in fact, all set in Hawaii. But Joe Baker Is Dead occurred to me as I was working on, let's see, King Herod Died of Cancer, and then I wrote Henrietta, and I realized that I had a character in there who was a peripheral character to the story, but he was mentioned in both of them. And I thought, this is all set in the same place, and these people don't know each other, but they're in the same environment. So then I deliberately wrote stories in which Joe Baker was an extra character. For instance, in The Poet's Daughter, the only connection is that the main character, Kay Larkin, works in a beauty shop where Joe Baker's widow has her hair done. But his name had to appear in every story. And I thought it was interesting if I could just get it out in the open that he was dead. Although he's not dead in the first story, and he dies in the second story. After the University of Missouri Press accepted that collection, they asked for one more story. And they really wanted me to do something with Joe Baker's girlfriend who appears in the second story, but I decided to go with his son instead. So that last story, Faithfully Departed, is one that I really wrote after the collection was accepted. I just sort of wanted to tie the whole thing up that he was dead, and he's been dead a year now by the time the book's over. The Alibi Cafe, those stories are connected, in my mind, only thematically. Some of them are set in St. Louis, some in rural Missouri, and two in Hawaii. But they all seem to be connected by people who are trying to live up to expectations that they put on themselves or the way other people think of them, and they can't quite, or other people's judgments seem a little too harsh. So that seemed to me the main connection there.
It's interesting that King Herod Died of Cancer was the first story that you wrote for that collection.
It was.
Because it's by far the funniest story, and it's just a hilarious story about this priest, Father Fisher.
Yeah.
He sort of developed a form of Tourette syndrome where he...
Yeah, you're right.
And Mary, I'm just going to have you read the first few pages of the opening.
This is about a priest who's having a lot of problems, and I knew a number of priests, I'll say that. And so many of them seemed odd to me, and even the ones that didn't. I used to really wonder about their lives and why would you choose that life and how do you rationalize it to yourself and why do you keep going? Now, anyway, this is King Herod Died of Cancer.
Mary Troy reading from her collection, Joe Baker Is Dead.
At first, there were stories about Father Fisher that had the feel of jokes. Did you hear what he said about King Herod at midnight mass? Have you heard him sing all six verses of Mary, Our Mother? Did you hear he told the religion class at St. Elizabeth's Academy that only ugly girls danced with one another? And what about poor Joe Baker's funeral, about standing right there in front of the casket and saying that the produce Joe sold and passed off as fresh was not, that Joe had operated his business on the sucker principle? Usually the parishioners of Holy Cross laughed, reducing Father Fisher and anything he could say to the level of a vice president of the United States or a senile ancestor. Some, of course, did not see the humor. Some few claimed to be distracted by the off-key but relentless singing, by the use of the pulpit to say whatever irreverent or screwball thing came into his head. He interfered with their piety, they told Father Melampfe, the pastor. Something had to be done. Father Melampfe, his young, untroubled face tanned from his twice-weekly golf outings, nodded, tisk-tisk, and agreed 100%. But made no promises. That was the strategy, the approach to conflict his few detractors often cited, that had made him the youngest pastor in the St. Louis Archdiocese. Father Melampfe himself told Father Fisher jokes to the five other priests from his seminary class that he played poker with every Thursday evening, but explained that Father Fisher needed a place to work, a home. Without those, he would be back on the psychiatric ward, taking tranquilizers as if they were breath mints, and conversing with the Holy Spirit. Also, and Father Melampfe admitted it freely, someone had to take the early masses and hear the confessions scheduled for every other Saturday. Father Fisher was good at confession. He considered it his specialty, and that in itself was another oddity. confession in a dark booth, sins whispered through a screen, or any kind of confession, for that matter, was out of style. It had gone out in the early 60s with the Latin Mass and head coverings for women. But just as some grandmothers and great-grandmothers still said the rosary every night, there were some parishioners who wanted to confess often and who preferred the secrecy of the confessional. Father Fisher preferred the anonymous method, too. He liked the challenge of guessing the sinner's identity, calling him by name at the end for shock value, perhaps asking after the wife and kids. There were those, too, whom he refused to forgive. He would not grant absolution for lukewarm, insipid sins that started as good intentions. Natalie Ross, a pretty and sincere St. Elizabeth girl, was one he refused. In trying to fix a shy classmate up with a prom date, Natalie had humiliated and embarrassed the girl, had made her feel even more unwanted. And what Natalie had done was not even a sin, not technically anyway, but though Father Fisher explained that, Natalie showed up every other Saturday and through the screen that glistened gold in the half-light asked God to forgive her. "I cannot do it," Father Fisher said each time. "Come on, Father," Natalie would answer. "I'm asking God, not you." "Then go through someone else. Through me, he says no." And after a time, Father Fisher began teasing Natalie if he saw her as he chaperoned the teen dances or greeted worshipers after Sunday Mass. "See you Saturday," he would say, and wink to make her blush to the brown roots of her blonde hair. She reminded him of girls he used to date before he entered the seminary, girls who wore dotted Swiss dresses and crinoline petticoats and who giggled when he asked them out. She reminded him, too, of the therapists and social workers and aides he had tried in vain to avoid while in the hospital. He suspected she came to him every other Saturday to help him as much as herself, to make him feel useful. He was sure of it. She was a well-meaning bitch who had caught the scent of a wounded soul.
That's the beginning of the short story, King Herod Died of Cancer, from Mary Troy's book, Joe Baker is Dead. She's talking here with UMKC fiction writer Michael Pritchett for New Letters on the Air.
Your first collection, Joe Baker is Dead, seems to have a lot of Catholic-inspired, Catholic-influenced kinds of of stories. And the second collection, not so much. Was that conscious in any way, that you were more interested in those issues in the first book than in the second?
Probably. So much of the life in South St. Louis was centered around churches, especially the old-fashioned kind of life that was leaving. And also, I was raised a Catholic, and my mother in particular is a very devout Catholic, but devout not in the way of this sort of new breed of fundamentalist Catholics, but devout in the way that way back when Vatican II happened in the 60s, she took guitar just so she could play, you know, God is Love on the guitar and things like that. And, you know, she became like this real sort of up with people sort of person that you could only stand to be around a little bit. But then she got over that. But Catholicism has always been a part of my background. I really don't consider myself much of a Catholic anymore. In fact, it never really took with me, I guess, except as something that was interesting, and I could see it as a motive for other people's actions.
It seems to me that your characters are never, it seems like you never entirely exonerate them of responsibility for the situations that they find themselves in. It seems like it's always partly their responsibility, and really the only story I can think of where it may not be is Turning Colder. But you always make sure that they have had some part in their downfall.
Right. We do that to ourselves, don't we? I mean, we don't do it on purpose. We don't say, well, I have this decision to make. If I choose A, I will probably ruin my life, and in 10 years I'll be sorry, so I'll do it. It doesn't seem that way at the time, but if you look back at the decisions you've made, you can see that, yes, I decided to do this. Or maybe I didn't decide so consciously, but for some reason or other, I'm the one that did it. I'm the one that took this path and not the other path.
Now, the stories that you base in Hawaii, because I think that I count at least three or four in the new collection, the Alibi Cafe, that are Hawaii stories. They take place in paradise, but they're sad stories. I mean, were you surprised that writing about Hawaii didn't sort of change the tone of the stories?
Well, I was happy in Hawaii, in a sense, but it seemed like a sad place to me. A lot of people I knew there were sad, and part of that was because they went to Hawaii with expectations. Most of the people I knew there were people from the mainland who had gone to Hawaii, kind of the way I did, after a divorce and thinking, you know, I'll start a new life. And it wasn't quite as magical as they thought. It was expensive. Jobs were really hard to find. It wasn't the magical, fantastic experience. So there were just a lot of, especially women, I knew a lot of very sad women, youngish sort of women, you know, in their late 20s, early 30s, who were looking for something that they weren't sure what it was, but they probably weren't going to find it. And it was becoming clear to them they weren't going to find it. Hawaii was a sad place for me, too, because I wasn't writing yet. I hadn't started writing. Well, I'd started writing in Hawaii, but before I started, I had this feeling that something in my life wasn't complete. I mean, I had a good job, and I liked it, and I had friends, and, you know, all that stuff was wonderful, and it was great being there. But I would wake up at 3 in the morning and think, what am I doing with my life? Why am I here? And in a way, I think that idea permeates all of my Hawaii memories and collections of Hawaii. I also think it's interesting to contrast this idea of paradise with reality.
Right.
You know, just because there are beaches there doesn't mean you're going to be happy any happier than you are in South St. Louis.
Right. The first story in Alibi Cafe, We're Still Keenies, also is probably the funniest story in that collection. But that doesn't tend to really be typical of the rest of the stories in either collection. They seem like you sort of let yourself go in those two stories and really sort of have fun, but the other stories are much more serious. Could you talk a little bit about your approach to storytelling, if you see a real strong difference between your funny stories and your serious ones?
Everything that is funny is also sad. Depends on your perspective. It depends on if it happens to you or if this priest is the one who buries your father. So things are either funny or sad depending on your closeness to it, your connection to it. Although there are some stories in the Alibi Cafe in particular that I think are not funny at all. Turning Colder. I made the mistake once of reading Turning Colder to an audience. And when it was over, they didn't applaud, they didn't do anything. They just were sitting there with their mouths hanging open like they were all going to go commit suicide or something. It was horrible. But there are some stories that just are sad, that there's no humor that will redeem them, but not many. I do think that most things are a combination. And after Joe Baker, it was funny, a lot of people were coming up to me and saying, oh, it's such a funny book. And a woman I taught with said, you know, that surprises me that people say that because I think they're all very sad. And I said, well, they are sad. I think they're both.
The endings of your stories are very frequently just devastating. And you and I have been on a panel where we've talked about endings.
Right, that's right.
So I was particularly studying your endings as I was looking through all of your stories. It seems like while you have these stories that can be very dark, but then you also have really funny stories like the Father Fisher story, there's an amazing defiance in the characters. It seems like the culture is pushing at them from so many different directions, trying to make them be certain things. And although they may fail to be loving, they may fail in so many different ways, it seems like they never fail to be defiant. Mm-hmm. And that's so great at the end of Do You Believe in the Chicken Hanger, when she has to get up and say that she's sorry for her adultery. But then she turns it, and right after she's apologized, she then tells a lie.
A lie. Uh-huh.
And says, by the way, it was fun.
Right, right.
When in fact we know it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. He was impotent and it was a bad experience. It's that defiance, mm-hmm, I guess, that seems to really characterize your stories.
I'm glad you noticed that, because they are. My characters are defiant. They don't like being defined. They don't like being whatever they're supposed to be. they don't know who they are, but they certainly know they're not what these other people say they should be. And sometimes they try to be it, but they really aren't. And they're tough. I think they're mostly tough people. That's why I know that they'll survive even after I finish writing about them. They're going to keep going on.
I guess the characters that continue to stay in my mind, I really continue to think about that little girl in Turning Colder.
Yeah.
And I wonder, after you have already said that you regret ever reading that before an audience, I wonder if you would be willing to read just the ending from that story for us so that we can hear your lowest notes as a writer.
Okay. The story is about Marcy, who has accidentally killed a baby. She dropped him. She's babysitting baby Jonathan. He was 5 months old, and he wriggled out of her arms and fell on the floor while the mother was in the room, but the mother was taking care of another child, an older child, who needed more care. Sissy is Marcy's mother, and the Peases are the couple who have lost their child. Marcy is having a hard time at the funeral, so.
This will be Mary Troy reading from her story in the Alibi Cafe, Turning Colder.
On the Friday morning of the week following the 4th of July, when the mourners clustered around the tiny grave on a hillside in Calvary Cemetery, the Peases cried quietly, just as Marcy had known they would, and Susan's mother and Sissy wiped away a few tears of their own. Susan cried louder than anyone, though, and Marcy was jealous, especially when Susan ended up with the hiccups. Marcy knew her mother was jealous, too, so she tried to cry. She thought of her mother, of how she would feel if her mother died, of her father dying in flames 9 years ago. She pretended Susan was dead. She even remembered the saddest part when Bambi's mother died. Nothing worked. The policeman had called her not normal. She looked around and saw the Bible lady standing off from the crowd under an elm tree. One of them had reported her behavior as strange and had told the police that Marcy refused to call the ambulance. The other one, the police did not tell which one said what, said Marcy looked almost happy as she turned and ran. Marcy had heard it all as her mother told Susan's mother what the police said the Bible lady said. They had called her a strange little girl. When Marcy looked back to the center of the pale yellow tent stretched over the grave, she saw Mrs. Pease slump against Mr. Pease, saw him make the others who sat in the front row move so he could stretch her out across the folding chairs. Had Mrs. Pease been told Marcy saw Bambi after baby Jonathan died? Either way, Marcy knew she would never be able to talk to the Peases again. And knowing that almost did it, almost produced the tears that would have proved her normal. But even then, the tears stung her eyes from behind, filled up the folds of her eyelids, but did not fall, would not. If she felt just one, she would turn to her mother, show her. But maybe they were right, all of them. She could no longer cry. It was more than a week later as she lay in bed, unable as usual to sleep until just before it was time to get up and dress for summer camp, that she heard them fight about her. "Something is wrong with her," Jake said. "Red says she doesn't play with the other kids at camp." "Red may not see everything," Sissy said. "Stop pretending and face facts," Jake said. "She doesn't even seem to miss Susan, call her after camp. It's not natural. We should have seen it even before when she wanted to help Helen Pease instead of playing." "Well, if you think something's wrong, do something besides talk. I can't take care of everything all by myself." "You don't have to act so burdened. I'm trying to help." "Then talk to her." "She won't talk to me," Jake said. "She follows your lead in that." "Oh, so now there's something wrong with me, too. The truth is, I talk more than you listen." Marcy left her bed and stood in the open doorway. These fights used to make her hide under the sheet, used to make her pray for an end, pray that the Peases wouldn't hear. Now she wanted to listen. It was further proof of how cold she was. Soon they were talking about Marcy's father. Sissy always mentioned him when the fight got going good, and Jake invariably said something about how he, too, wished the SOB were still alive, and Sissy would be driving him crazy. Sissy would say at least he would have had a good job. He was so talented. And Jake could say Sissy could have her freedom any time. As Marcy listened, she anticipated the crash, which always came, though its cause varied, and which signaled the end of the fight. Soon after the crash, one of them would leave, and that someone was most often Jake, who was better at it, who could make his car roar as he backed it down the drive and spun around on the street, could make his car sound mad, too. Sometimes a crash was Sissy throwing her silver-backed hand mirror at Jake, and once she threw the bedside lamp at the wall. Jake threw one of his boots so hard the last time they had a real fight, threw it at the wall above the bed and not at Sissy, that it made a hole in the drywall that Sissy wanted to cover with a picture. Jake said leave it as it was, though, to remind him of his own temper and keep him humble. When the crash came, Marcy held her breath and flattened herself against the wall, waiting to see who would leave. It was Jake, and he rushed past her, slammed the front door on his way out, and made his tires squeal all the way to the end of the block. Sissy's sobs, as usual, filled the house. But this time, instead of crying quietly herself, Marcy knocked on her mother's bedroom door and entered as Sissy choked out, "Go away." "I'm sorry I'm not natural," Marcy said. "I'll try to be better." "Can't I have a little privacy in my own house?" Sissy said. "Go to bed." "I don't know why I went to the movie," Marcy said, inching closer to the bed, wanting to climb in and touch her mother. "I know, I know. You can't help being what you are." Sissy rolled over, turned face down on the bed. "It must be easier not to feel as much." She cried into Jake's pillow. Marcy stood for a while, listening to the muffled sobs turn to snores, and then went back to her room. It was still dark when she heard Jake return, and when she finally fell asleep, she dreamed she was stuck in mud up to her knees, and monsters who looked like Belinda were attacking her. A month later, Sissy Manning took another day off work to meet with the principal of Marcy's school and with Marcy's soon-to-be fourth-grade teacher. As she explained it to Susan's mother over the phone that evening, "I wanted them to know Marcy is a little, you know, strange, like everyone said. I thought it would be easier if they knew beforehand." Marcy sat in the living room as she listened dry-eyed to her mother's conversation. She stared at the yellow house across the street and down one, the house where Helen's hugs and baby Jonathan's smiles had created a happiness that proved fragile after all. And she pictured the inside of her as empty, her body as hollow and cold, and turning colder.
Mary Troy, reading the end of her story, Turning Colder, from her book of short fiction, The Alibi Cafe, published in 2003 by Bookmark Press. She also read from her first collection, Joe Baker is Dead, from the University of Missouri Press. Her third book, Cookie Lily, is hot off the press from Southern Methodist University. If you'd like to purchase a copy of today's show, call toll-free 888-548-2477. That's 888-LIT-AIRS. Or email radio@newletters.org. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the quarterly magazine published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial funding from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Dennis Conroe, Bianca McCullough, and Alex Smith. Thanks also to Michael Pritchett for interviewing Mary Troy. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.